Okay, I guess we're going to start, since people are still coming in, but we'll go. I'm Michael Villette. I'm the Deputy Project Manager and Senior Architect for Virtualization within the Internal Revenue Service. I'm also the Senior Architect for Exchange, so it goes hand in hand nicely for what we're going to talk about, virtualizing Microsoft Active Directory Domain Controllers. If you're having a hard time hearing, especially in the back, just raise your hand and I'm getting over a very bad cold and my voice is just coming back, so hopefully you can hear me. During this session, I'm very open to questions during the presentation, so if you have them, just raise your hand and when you ask them, speak extremely loud because my ears are also quite plugged up right now. We're going to discuss the IS overview. We're going to just quickly go over high-level Microsoft Active Directory environment within the IRS, our high-level Microsoft Exchange 2003 environment, our Exchange 2003 configuration, domain controller configuration, an overview of our existing production VMware infrastructure. We're going to then just quickly cover why are we virtualizing, and then more importantly, I figure you're all here, why are we virtualizing our domain controllers? We'll discuss the methodology that we went through for doing this testing. We'll cover our test results, the conclusions, suggestions on what we need to look at for some things that we came across, and we'll discuss then quickly what we're going to be doing next with VMware from an Exchange domain controller perspective, and then again any close up questions and answers. Most of you probably already know who and what the IRS is, but since we do have coming from, I think it's 70 different countries and all, I felt it important that we at least mention the IRS mission is to provide America's taxpayers top quality service by helping them understand and meet their tax responsibilities and keep their funds to the tax while with integrity for your son. You guys are going to get me in trouble, come on. But seriously, what I want to just say here is I've been in the field for 18 years. I am a civil servant. I'm also a taxpayer. I feel that it is my personal duty as a civil servant to do whatever I can to ensure that the tax dollars that we are spending in the IRS that I have control over, that we are maximizing them and we are being as efficient as possible. Clearly not from just, from an IT perspective, because all of you as well are clearly here for VMware because virtualization does save money, so that is one of the factors. And also it's just going to increase your efficiency. So I felt that, this was important for us to mention. But to the technical stuff now. Our high-level Microsoft Active Directory environment, we have 24-hour availability, over 100,000 user objects. We've got about 136,000 employees, around 30,000 are seasonal, starting around January through the April timeframe during the tax season. We have separate Active Directory sites for our Exchange servers. We're currently running Microsoft Active Directory with Windows 2003. We are in native mode. We have 73 sites and 99 domain controllers at the time that this presentation was created. So again, to reiterate though, we do have separate AD sites for Exchange in our non-Exchange environment. One of the primary reasons we did that was we wanted to ensure that the Exchange servers were always guaranteed the response and resources that they need, in particular if they're hitting the catalog servers for all the LDAP requests for every time a message or whatnot is delivered, the Exchange servers have to hit those GCs. High-level Microsoft Exchange environment. We average about 1.5 million messages handled every day, greater than 500 million messages every year, which includes service transactions and whatnot. We provide 24-hour availability, less than 5-minute maximum delivery time for all messages. Usually, I think at this point, we're around 93 to 95% of all messages are delivered in less than a minute, point to point, around the country, regardless of message size. We're running Exchange 2003. We are in native mode. We just finished switching over to that about 2 months ago. We have 12 Exchange sites, or better known as administrative groups. We have 58 messaging servers, not including the bridgehead servers, OS front-end servers, things of that nature. Those are mailbox servers. We have over 90,000 mailboxes that are user mailboxes. I didn't bother listing the stats for organizational mailboxes and whatnot. We have over 20,000 public folders. For those of you that are Exchange administrators, you can already imagine what a headache and nightmare that is. That's a whole other story. Mailbox quota, when we went from Exchange 5.5 to Exchange 2003, we upped it to 150 meg. Our Exchange 2003 server configuration. Our physical servers are HTDL580G2s. Those are quad processors Xeon 2 gigahertz, 4 gig of RAM per server. On physical servers, we have 2 internal hard drives, 73 gig, 15K IPM, RAID 1, and it's configured to boot from the SAN. The databases for the Exchange servers, we have 96 73 gig drives in our SAN, configured in a single disk group running Bluetooth 5. The transaction log consists of 24 73 gig drives running Bluetooth 1. The disk backup, what we do is disk staging. So when we're doing a backup, we don't back up directly to tape. We first back up to the SAN, and then let that way we can do the backups anytime we want, whether it's immediate or later on, and there's no impact on Exchange. And that consists of 12 300 gig drives, again running Bluetooth 5. And then we have another disk group called Other. That's important, and you'll see why it starts to zoom where it goes for us. It consists of 36 73 gig drives in this disk group. The boot partitions that I referenced here, the physical servers, have the boot partitions in here running Bluetooth 1. The Exchange binaries for each of the servers is also here running Bluetooth 1. And the SMTPQ data is there running Bluetooth 1. So what that means is the other disk group is extremely underutilized. For any type of SAN, if you get 36 disks in a disk group, the other, how you're carving it up, you're going to find that that in particular is a very underutilized area for your disk I.O. Our domain control, yes, sir?
Yes, why do you boot from the SAN?
Question is, why do we boot from the SAN? Originally, when we did this architecture, we were going to do clustering. In fact, I was looking to virtualize our Exchange environment from 2 years ago, but VMware didn't have the quad SMP at the time. So what we're doing, we decided that going from Exchange 5.5 to 2003 was enough complexity in the environment that doing clustering was just going to probably cause us issues. So to give us some type of failback or failover, we have at each of the sites where I have Exchange, we have what we call a standby server. So if you have Mailbox Server 1 fail, motherboard blows, all we have to do remotely is remap the runs that go to that mailbox server, to the standby server, reboot it, and it boots off the OS partition on the SAN, and we're back in business. And it works extremely well, and unfortunately, we've had to do that several times, but at least we know that it works. The domain controllers now. Our physical domain controllers for Exchange are HTDL-880G3s. Those are dual processing Xeon 2.8 GHz, 4 GB of RAM, between 3 and 5 internal hard drives, depending on the site that we were having it, and a 73 gig, 15K IPM, RAID 5. Drive D is where we have the ntdx.bit file. What we've done with that is, so we have, again, three to five hard drives on the physical server, and we just have a C partition and a D partition spinning across all those drives. But again, at least for best practices, we had the bit file and the transaction logs associated with the bit file on a separate drive setter. Our virtual domain controllers are single processor Xeon 3 GHz, 3.6 GB of RAM because we're running ESX 2.x, so we're limited to that. The C drive is one virtual disk running Z-RAID 5. And the D drive is a second virtual disk, I've been running V85, and the MTBS DS bit file is located on that V drive. So where this is coming into play is the partitions that we have, our VMSS2 partitions, is on that 36-bit disk group that we're sharing with the production exchange binaries, SMTPQ data and whatnot. The main reason we did that is as we were first starting doing our VMware deployment, we wanted to get going on this, I'm not going to say with $0 cost, but with the cheapest cost involved. And for us, what that turned out to do was just purchasing the physical host and the VMware licenses and use existing SAN space to get more of a proof of concept out there so our administrators and ultimately my executives could see that this is not just kind of a pie in the sky thing that I've been touting for several years now, but it actually does work. Our existing ESX production environment. We have 13 main locations within the IRS. We have 10 campuses and 3 computing centers, where the computing centers is where our mainframes are for the majority of the tax processing, and the 10 campuses are usually the submission places where in the past that's where you used to mail in your tax returns. There are things clearly are now changing with the concept of e-filing. We have 3 hosts per site right now in our phase 1 deployment. We're using ESX 2.5.3 build 22981, Virtual Center 1.x. We're leveraging NetIQ to monitor 2 virtual machines, such as the main controllers. So both for physical, virtual, our exchange servers, NetIQ, App Manager is what we're using. And we're also leveraging VisionCore ESX Charter for monitoring the ESX host environment. VisionCore has been very gracious in allowing us to evaluate their technology for over 6 months now, so we could really get a good feel for it. Our SAN that we're using for both, again, for our phase 1 virtualization deployment and for our production exchange environment, are HP EVA 5000s. We're sharing, again, a disk group with the exchange server boot partitions, the exchange binaries, and the exchange SMTPQ data. The servers that we are using as our hosts are the HP ML 570 Generation 3. That's a quad Xeon, single core, 2.8 GHz system. We only got a handful of those, I think maybe 5 of those out there. That was, those were servers that originally we had a group that was trying to come up with just some off-the-cuff VR instantiation without even a concept of virtualization. And when I got wind of what they were doing, I convinced them, the servers were already purchased, so I just said, look, up the RAM to 32 gig of RAM, buy the VMware licenses, and let me show you what we can do for what we were thinking of for VR. So we claim those machines now as part of our infrastructure. But the bulk of our systems are the HP DL580 Generation 3. That's a quad Xeon dual core 3 GHz, 32 gig of RAM, dual QLogic 2 gig HDAs, and 2 dual port Intel Pro 1000 NICs. Our physical host loads for when you're doing the evaluation and the statistics gathering for this presentation. At the time, we were running 18 virtual machines at the farm in our Washington, D.C. office, which was running on the host that we did the testing on. So prior to us then virtualizing the domain controllers, 18 virtual machines, we're averaging 18% total CPU usage on the physical host, averaging 0.3% ready, and 20 gig out of 32 gig of RAM was in use. So what we did was, since we had multiple hosts at our Washington, D.C. farm, we took all the virtual machines and we remotioned them over, say, to host 1, which is one of the DL580G3s, the quad dual cores. We purposefully put all of them onto a single host, and then what you're going to see is when we virtualized the domain controllers, we also had them on that single host. Because if we would have said, you know, if I came to and said I had 20 virtual machines spread out across 3 hosts and the host isn't really doing anything, you're not really seeing any good results. So we purposely wanted a single host with some load, a realistic load for us. And then again, our constraint is the memory, since we had 20 gig of RAM already in use, and we only had 32 gig. So the load that you're going to be seeing is focused on a single host with everything running on it. Obviously, in a best practice environment, though, you know, want your domain controllers on multiple hosts for obvious reasons. So here's the back end of the 580G3, just so you can have an idea on how we actually have architected it. Again, this is using 2.5.3, not 3.0, so some things will have changed. So we have obviously the RILO connection, console and vMotion, we use the onboard NICs, and we got again the two HDAs running two logics. And then what we do is we have two dual port gigabit NICs. And what we did was we created two teams we call SuperNIC and SuperNIC 1. For additional story level, what we do is we bond the top two NICs of each one as one bond. In this case, we call it SuperNIC. And then the bottom two here, SuperNIC 1. So at least in the event that one of the cards actually goes bad for whatever reason, we don't lose either of our two virtual switches. With ESX3, what we're doing is we're taking all of these and collapsing them into a single bond called SuperNIC, and then we're taking our vMotion and console and we're bonding those together. Our configuration of the communications to the fan is very typical, nothing exciting. Most of you, or if not all of you, are very aware of this. We've got the host with two HDAs, we've got two fiber switches. So each HDA goes to each fiber switch then communicates to first processor 1, first processor 2. What you're seeing, however, here is two fans. We have an exchange fan and a corporate fan. Right now we're using the exchange fan, as I said, the 36-disk group that's very underutilized. We're in the process right now of expanding the available disk capacity of the corporate fan. As we're now finding our own success is our worst enemy, as we're getting more requests now for virtual machine creations than we can even keep up with right now, and disk space is one of the limiting factors. So we're actually going to be having our ESX host spanning multiple fans for the disk capacity. We will not be extending, doing DMFSD extents between the fans. They're either going to have the VMFS partitions will be limited and isolated to an individual fan. You can have DMDKs on both of them, but we're not going to do extents. So why are we virtualizing? The average time to procure and bring on a new line of service is 60 to 100 days within the IRS. That includes site prep challenges. We have some locations just to get power into the place can take 6 months. No joking. We're able to reduce the time between a customer request and delivery for IT services. We can provide higher availability of services, leveraging tools such as vMotion to address hardware maintenance. That's been one of our key things right there, is we are now able to do all our hardware maintenance during the production day. We do not need to pay employees overtime. We do not need to send out email notifications to our customers saying we need to have planned outages, which again, typically our customers don't think, God, these IT people don't have their act together. Why do they have to bring these systems down? So it's been very beneficial for us for that. We're able to provide cheaper, more advanced disaster recovery options for critical and non-critical Intel systems, quicker bare metal recovery, and the ability to replicate virtual machine delta in real time to a recovery facility. This is leveraging the VisionCore ESX replicator, and we're moving towards using that. We're able to deploy new systems without obligating hardware. We've got between 3,000 to 4,000 systems that the project that I'm heading is going to be dealing with virtualizing and doing consolidation. One of the challenges we have is we're trying to grab the, you know, what everyone seems to call the low-hanging fruit. Let's virtualize now because it's easy, it's cheap per se, and you can get an immediate ROI, but we also want to do OS consolidation. Well, we can do that after we virtualize, because then once you consolidate, you just delete the other virtual machine instead of having unused hardware hanging around. And cost avoidances. We've documented that for about every 20 servers we virtualize, we avoid spending about $250,000. Why are we virtualizing domain controllers? Our initial deployment of domain controllers pre-exchange 2003 consisted of a single DCGC at each campus location. The DCGCs were placed there where we had high number of clients based on the local and wide area network. Unfortunately, though, right now, if the DCGC went down, there is no redundancy at that location to avoid clients going across the LAN. Obviously, Active Directory is designed for things like that happen, so if the client is hitting a domain controller right now for authentication and whatnot, it goes down, it's going to go out and find another one. Obviously, you set up your AD site, so you isolate and limit your traffic. You don't want them going over the LAN. So we do have that issue right now that in our Washington office, if the non-exchange domain controller went down, the whole Washington office will be going, say, to Martinsburg or somewhere else to find a domain controller. It'll work. Our customers won't realize it, but our LAN folks will, and obviously you don't want to do that. Implementing virtual domain controllers to complement the physical provided us a no-cost solution. We have extreme budgetary challenges, more than ever in the last 2 years, and it's only going to get worse for us. So we needed to come up with a means. The OS license per se is a lot easier for us internal to fund than it is to get hardware. So by virtualizing now, we're able to get these additional domain controllers for the redundancy at our campus locations without having to spend hardware money. And also, we implemented our domain controller several years ago. We're at the point for the refresh cycle. So now what we want to do is, instead of refreshing all the domain controllers with physical boxes, we wanted to see, could we actually virtualize these? Is this something truly viable to do, or is it too risky? And so again, that's the result of what this presentation is on what we did and what the results are. And then lastly, we've got new projects coming in all the time. We're working towards more of a working remotely environment in the IRS. So people are now coming in more and more over the VPN solution or other type of things. And what happens if you have a project that someone comes up and you need more resources from an Active Directory environment? You can't wait for 2-3 months it's going to take to buy another domain controller. With VMware now, we're able to get a domain controller up and running in about 24 hours. Clearly, the VM itself, 5-10 minutes, but the replication, you know, in about a day, so we can be more flexible for our dynamic changing environment. Assumptions for this. In our environment, Exchange 2003 will be the heaviest user of domain controllers. Over 95% of the IRS is now running Outlook 2003. Each location where Exchange is present, there are dedicated domain controllers, as I said, for just Exchange. So as you can see here, a Washington site called NCFD, and then there's an Exchange AD site called EXCH-NCFD. Testing performed in a production environment with the understanding that the test data is not a controlled element. The reason we did this, because anyone can just go into a lab and test this stuff. You can get your stress things and say, oh great, when I virtualize with this, it can handle so many LDAP requests, and here's my response times. That's nice in a lab environment. What people want, and what we wanted, was to see how is this going to work in a real world environment where you can't control what's going to be happening. Now, you can do iometer or even with Exchange, do load sim and such, but that's still not real world. That's just seeing what your maximum capability to handle is. During our testing, there was not a significant delta to the normal replication traffic for the AD environment to cause abnormal increase in AD replication traffic. Secondly, what we were very concerned about was we wanted to make sure there was nothing special going on during our testing period, you know, with someone extending the schema for something else other than Exchange, or really someone importing, you know, 15,000 objects suddenly because we're hiring, you know, the temp workers for the coming tax season or whatnot. We want to make sure we're looking at what a normal environment was for us, and we found it nothing really abnormal was taking place. And the same thing for Exchange. We wanted to make sure that our Exchange environment was not having an abnormal surge or reduction in the amount of mail traffic that was taking place, because clearly if we're having a surge and it's just a momentary thing, just say during that time period, or a reduction, then really the testing of this is slightly flawed. So we kept a very close eye on that, and we found that there really weren't any significant deltas. Here's our disclaimer of what we're going to suddenly show you now. No two environments are alike. We are not stating that the metrics we use to determine the performance of a domain controller or a messaging server are what you need to use in your environment. The performance counters and what we've done is what the IRS considers important and what the important metrics are. You need to determine that for yourself. Hopefully you'll agree with the ones we've done, and hopefully it'll help you in your environment. But again, you need to make that decision yourself. So our methodology. We needed to ensure that physical domain controllers were the only systems we used by exchange. We gathered the necessary statistics. We then transferred in the virtual domain controllers, transferred out the physical domain controllers. We gathered the necessary statistics again. Again, as I stated, we ensure the exchange loads between the two gathering time periods are within reasonable similar patterns. We monitored traffic pattern similarity. We monitored total messages sent in delivery time, and we monitored total size of messages. We also monitored the physical host to account for any unusual loads by other production virtual machines, because if we suddenly had one of the virtual machines just really pegging out or something, that was an abnormal situation. Then again, that would have kind of skewed the data. And fortunately, during that time period, we weren't running into that situation. The tools we used, Virtual Center 1.4, the ESX 2.5 CME, NetIQ App Manager, Solana App Analyzer, and VisionQuote ESX Charter. Gathering metrics on the physical DC. So again, as I said, what we do is we have two AD sites. This is done at our Washington office. The non-AD site has a single physical domain controller, and our exchange agent site has three physical domain controllers and four exchange mailbox servers. To ensure that your exchange servers are in fact only using those physical domain controllers, we kept a very close eye on the DS access option within the properties of the servers. As you can see here, we clearly had to change our domain name and the server name stuff for security purposes. When you see CP3, that's a physical machine, and just computer physical and Exchange 2003. So as you can see, this is showing that our exchange servers were in fact using only those physical domain controllers that were in that AD site. The next thing we did was we need to create our virtual domain controllers. We created those in the non-exchange AD site. Once they were created, we waited 24 hours before we did anything. Again, depending on your environment, you might only have to wait an hour or two. For us, we have over 100,000 user objects. It really only took about maybe a couple hours to do it, but again, we were in no rush to suddenly get these going and start changing things over. So we just waited a day or two until we were ready to do the next phase of the testing. We then needed to transfer the virtual domain controllers into the Exchange AD site. By doing this, and we started looking at DS access, we then saw after a period of time that the exchange servers were using some of the physical domain controllers, and we also saw that they started tapping into the virtual domain controllers. So we let that sit for a little while. We waited then also over a weekend before we did the next step, which was more invasive, which is moving the physical domain controllers out of that AD site and into the non-exchange AD site. What the result of this was, it took about an hour or so, if I recall correctly, and as soon as we do the move, obviously the exchange servers continue using those domain controllers that their DS access was home to. But after a certain period of time, the exchange servers will do a refresh to see what domain controllers are available for it to use, and it realizes that these physical domain controllers are no longer in the same AD site that they're in. So Exchange will then do DNS queries to find what domain controllers are available in that AD site, and then they went and they rehomed, as you can see here, to VPC AD, whatever. So at that point, you monitored DS access and ensured that the virtual domain controllers were the only ones that were servicing our exchange servers. Here's the counting that we used. Overall CPU load, network utilization, main cache hit rate, AV client sessions, DC availability, intersite replication to both inbound and outbound, intrasite replication, inbound and outbound, disk IO. We focused on the disk IO only on the D drive. We really didn't care about the C. We figured, you know, it's the operating system, big deal, but the domain controller is going to be pounded on the NTDS bit file in particular. AV response time, connection time to LDAP, localhost root DSE. DNS, we want to look at CPU usage, availability, and memory usage of DNS. In our environment, and we are changing it, but in our current environment, all domain controllers are global catalog servers, and they're also all domain DNS servers. We did that for certain reasons I won't bother going into. Memory usage, we're going to check, monitor memory page fault usage, virtual memory usage, physical memory usage. And then from the ESX host side, we want to monitor percent ready and the ESX CPU load. Here's the result. We found for CPU usage, the average on the physical was only about 1.3%. And I would figure that, you know, for those of you that take time to monitor your own domain controls, you're probably finding very similar things. There's nothing special here, you know, even though we're, you know, 100,000 users, but from this is isolated in exchange. So clearly, even with three dual processor domain controllers with we had about 12,000 exchange users in that at that administrative group, the domain controller isn't sweating at all on a physical box. However, when we virtualized, we did see that there was a difference of 5.8%. The virtual domain controller does work harder. And that makes sense if you think about it, because the physical box is a dual processor hyper-threaded, and the virtual machine is a single processor virtual machine, non-hyper-threaded. So it makes perfect sense that you're going to see that the virtual machine is... you'll see that the virtual machine is going to work a little harder. Just on a side note, I didn't put in this presentation, I didn't have time, but I then converted our domain controllers over to dual processor, and I saw that the CPU usage actually dropped to about 2.5%. The network utilization. Physical network average was about 0.11% of the network utilization. We're using gigabit connectivity for our physical and the virtual domain controllers. And the virtual we saw 0.1%. So really, utilization difference 0.01%. Essentially, it's negligible. I mean, again, we weren't seeing that the domain controller load from a network perspective was really anything that the system couldn't handle. The main cache hit rate for the physical server, the average was 86%. The virtual, 86%. So again, success rate negligible on there. So we were very pleased to see that. AV client sessions. The physical server during that time, the average was 1,527 sessions. The virtual, the average was 1,597. Those sessions could account for your customers who are hitting those domain controllers for address book lookups, things of that nature. They were not for authentication. We had set up the LDAP server weight in DNS to 100 for us, which is extremely high. So they're the most unattractive domain controllers in our environment for any type of authentication. And the average difference, again, was 70 sessions. Really, that's nothing. So again, the loads that were on both the systems were extremely close during our testing periods. Domain controller availability, the physical 100% availability, virtual 100%. During our testing, we did not have to do any demotions. We had no issues with the hardware at the time, so we didn't have to do any monkeying around moving between the hosts. Yes, sir. I'm sorry?
What was the test period?
Our test period for each of these, we did 1 week each for the test period for this presentation. Subsequently, this data was gathered quite a while ago, earlier this year. We have been running now in our Washington, D.C. office only virtual domain controller for Exchange now, and that's been going on almost 4 months at this point, and I've been monitoring the data and the statistics since then, and they stay pretty much right in line with what you're seeing here. Again, we were just figuring, just taking a week for both of the systems with an accurate enough snapshot. Intra-site replication, inbound, physical average 109 bytes per second, virtual 98 bytes per second. You know, again, 10 bytes per second, very negligible. And again, of course, every once in a while, another one of the domain controllers suddenly became the bridgehead for whatever reason, which would explain why, you know, those two suddenly had a little bit of usage. Intra-site replication outbound. Clearly, it's obvious which ones were the bridgehead servers for the domain controllers. And again, you're talking a difference of about, you know, 0.9 to 1 byte per second on the outbound, negligible. Intra-site replication inbound, the average difference, 44 seconds, bytes per second for inbound, so again, very negligible. And outbound, the average of 278 bytes per second. Now again, for some of that accountability could be either just some additional deltas, maybe there was additional network traffic taking place, but at least in our opinion, we found that the network loads for performance were well acceptable, and we had no latency issues when we were looking at how long it took for deltas and outside the non-exchange AD site to replicate in and out of the exchange AD sites. AD response time, being a connection time to localhost, we estimated the average was 12 milliseconds physical, 12 milliseconds virtual. That was the average. As you can see, there was, you know, a slight variance there, but again, 3 milliseconds different time, negligible. The disk I/O, we were actually very interested in this because we were figuring actually that the virtual, I would have figured, would have been actually faster simply because the physical box had, say, between 3 and 5 disks running VA5, but yet for the virtual, I had a 36 disk group on a fiber channel CMIN. I was very surprised to see how close these were. I was actually figuring a little more noticeable. Again, you do see like here, the average read was 4.9 milliseconds here, average 4.42. This was, you know, a little less here, a little more here. But again, the bottom line that you want to take out of this is that the disk I/O for where we had the NTDF bit file was extremely comparable to that of what we had with a virtual machine. The key thing you want to keep in mind with this, however, if you do decide to virtualize your domain controllers, keep in mind we had 18 to 20 virtual machines non-related to this, so clearly we were still putting, you know, a little bit of load on the SAN. If you suddenly, you know, if I would have suddenly put like, I had a virtual machine running SQL or whatever that's pounding the SAN, then clearly we could have seen some rather noticeable differences here. So one of the key things you want to just keep in mind here is when you start virtualizing the critical infrastructure systems like the main controllers, just be very mindful for what else you are adding into that environment and always just keep monitoring. Now again, what we're doing is we take these stats and as we add more virtual machines into there, we then see, are we seeing statistical differences? And if we are, is the reduction acceptable or not? CPU usage, 0.5% for physical, 0.1% for virtual, so again, very negligible. DNS availability, our physical servers, it's a rare thing for us to have any outages today. It would be a hardware issue, and of course, virtual expected 100% availability, and during our testing, we did no demotions that could kind of skew the availability of resources and whatnot during this testing period. Memory usage, physical, we average 27 megs use of DNS. The virtual average 24 megs. So again, 2 meg difference, negligible. Memory page fault usage, physical, we average 2.65%, virtual, 1.56%. The only thing I could probably account for that is, again, that we only had 3.6 trillion, so perhaps how Windows was allocating, deallocating things, handled it just a little different with that 400 meg difference. Virtual memory usage, the physical average was 37% virtual memory usage. The virtual was 31% with an average of 6.5%. Again, negligible. I should have actually just called this entire session just virtualizing domain controllers. It's negligible. That's pretty much. I'm just thinking in my head here. I'm just saying negligible every slide. Physical memory usage, we average 81.75% physical memory usage. We average only 66% physical memory usage virtual. The difference of 15%. When I did this stat, though, it just kind of dawned on me this morning. I should have, at least taken into consideration what the percentage of reduction is between, 4 GB to 3.6 GB. So, the number's still, I think, reasonably accurate, but it is definitely skewed because I failed to account for that. So, forgive me for that. Email, the average message size during our testing, with the physical domain controllers, our average message size was 47.68 kilobytes. Virtual, just a little higher, 48. Again, negligible in the size of the messages during the testing period. The message count during that week trial period for both of them. The physical, we had 1.129 million messages delivered. Virtual, we had 1.179 million. Negligible. Email delivery times. The physical is 93% of all messages delivered under a minute. Virtual, 93%. Difference. Negligible. It's like, what was that like lady sitting there at Super? I should be, this is Super, isn't it? You guys got to work with me. It's kind of dry over here. Negligible on the next one. Great, that's the last one, so you can't do it. Yeah, I got some laughter. I was getting nervous that you guys were like falling asleep on me. As you can see the final tally there, the difference is CPU, 5% difference. Network utilization, 0.01%. The replication, outbound difference, 10%. Inbound, 10 bytes per second. Outbound, 0.9 bytes per second. Looking at disk I.O., on your the reads, writes, and changes disk per second, 0.3 milliseconds difference, 0.49, 0.03. AV response time, DNS CPU usage, memory usage. In particular, here, from a VMware perspective, the host, 0.3% CPU ready. What that really tells me is since there was no percent ready, you're always going to have some. You're never going to have zero, as far as I understand. Because that's so low, the percentage of stats that you're actually seeing with the virtual machines, you can actually take that and be very confident that those are accurate numbers. If I was reporting to you 5, 6% percent ready, then clearly all the stats I'd be talking about would be possibly skewed. As I'm sure you've seen in other presentations, everyone's always saying, when you're looking at, your performance metrics and things, you're only looking at it from that slice of time that any virtual machine is being given to a CPU. Well, in this case, because it's 0.3% CPU percent ready, I've been talking in ESX 2.5 window, every virtual machine effectively was getting 100%, or I'll say 99.7% of the time it needed CPU resources, it was getting it. And again, the average ESX load was about 18%. What's the conclusion? Microsoft Active Directory domain controllers can, in fact, be virtualized. You should virtualize them, especially just from a monetary standpoint, for saving you on hardware, and more importantly, the whole concept of vMotion and your high availability. VLS, I'm not overly concerned about that from a reason to virtualize a domain controller, but more importantly, the high availability and the vMotion. Get it so you have either little or no downtime, period. Even if you have multiple domain controllers, your goal should be that all of your, focus here on Windows, your Windows servers should always have 100% uptime, and if it's not, don't have it be because of hardware. You can't, obviously when you get patches, you've got to reboot and whatnot, that's out of your hands, But you shouldn't have your infrastructure have downtime because you have a bad motherboard or something. That's just like a key thing that I want you to take away with that. We saw the slightly higher CPU usage. Again, that was expected because we only had a single processor virtual machine versus the physical or dual processor with hyper-threading. And as I mentioned, we've been running now for the last 4 months at our Washington office, the virtual dimensions. We are not going back to the physical now. And I actually changed them from Grims and Giggles to being dual processor on the boxes, and I saw the CPU usage go down closer to what the physical, not exactly the physical, but I'm going to be changing them back ultimately to single processor. That's our goal, is have all VMs be single unless there's an actual need for it. Suggestions. Avoid implementing production virtual machines without two hosts. I personally would recommend three hosts. And the reason for three is now with ESX version 3, the high availability issue. Right now, if you have just two hosts, even if you're doing version 3, you have a host go down unless your other host has a lot of unused resources. HA will not be able to restart all of your virtual machines. So I would recommend you try to have a minimum of three and always have at least the available underlying unused resources be able to support at least the mission critical virtual machines you have on any other one. So if any given host dies, make sure the mission critical ones that are running on that will have resources to restart. Use a common external storage medium, iSCSI, Fibre Channel. Ensure multiple network connections are bonded. Again, minimum two. I'd recommend do 2, 3, 4 if you have the ability of multiple cores within your network infrastructure. Our computing centers will have actually the network bonded on one bond, but we'll have them going on to two separate cores. So you can actually have a single network core in your computer room go down, and the other core is running, and we have no network outage. And that gets a little more sophisticated, a little more expensive and all, but at least if you have real data centers, not like local offices, try to get that at least for your mission critical environments. Monitor closely, the four key things that everyone's been telling you: memory, CPU, disk, and network utilization. Make sure different virtual machines on different loads. Don't put all your domain controllers on a single host. What I talked about in this presentation, we did specifically that only for gathering the statistics and for the presentation. As soon as I was done collecting the statistics, I shuffled them out to other hosts, just a best practice. And test, and closely monitor. Again, once you take the step and you actually start virtualizing your domain controllers, and you should, and hopefully at least the information I've given you, and there's a couple other slides, very important slides here during the time just in I'll discuss. Anytime you're going to add another virtual machine onto your host, make sure before you do that, you already have gathered your statistics on what your normal operating environment is, what the normal loads are, what the normal results are. So when you introduce this new VM into the environment and you run into problems, it should be presumably easier for you to point and know that VM is what's causing suddenly whatever else is happening, because if everything was running smoothly before and this is your delta, that might be the catalyst for the issue. Time drift. This is a very critical thing. You have to make sure you understand and you address. Avoid the time drift issues with virtual machines. Now, there's an issue between a domain controller and a non-domain controller on how you're going to handle the time drift. For the non-domain controllers, what we did was we created a group in Active Directory we called, I think, the virtual servers, and we set up a GPO filter to have the members in that group have the Windows time service disabled. And then we configured the VM tools agent to synchronize between the virtual machine and the console operating system. The ESX host, we use NTP, and what we do is the PDC emulator in our root domain is syncing with an external time source in our environment. We have all of our ESX hosts use MTP and synchronize with that same host. Now, one interesting thing that I actually, earlier this week, I had opened a critical ticket with VMware on, because suddenly I had some of my folks come back in there saying, hey, we can't even get the minute time skew between our physical domain controller and virtual domain controller in our DC offices. And I was like, well, we shouldn't see that. And when I looked at the host, two hosts syncing to the same time server had a minute difference. And I was like, what the heck? So I go in and I restarted the time service. I redid the MTP, service and restart, and then everything was running fine again. But I was like, I looked at messages, kernel warning. I couldn't figure out what the heck's going on. So I open a ticket with VMware and I'm discussing with them. They're researching it, and the issue was with how frequent MTP will actually go and do the synchronization. Hopefully they're going to be updating. I think I carried the article on it because they had sent me something. Again, I've been sick this week, so I haven't done too much email in the evenings. But what we're going to be doing is we're going to be configuring through modifying the cron tab to do a resync. You might even do every 5 minutes. I mean, every 10 minutes.
Are you planning on using MTPD then to the cron tab, or are you planning on using MTP date? Because I think MTP, if it's running MTP, the daemon itself, it's not going to want to do a hard resync. And how are you going to handle hard times? If you reset your clock via MTP date, it's going to reset it. And any services that depend on time, it may crash, or
it may
run into problems as well.
The question is, what version are we going to use, MTP date or
MTP date
or
MTP?
To be honest, I don't know yet. I haven't finished reading what VMware has sent me, so I can't. I'm not sure yet. Yes, sir.
Is that the
file
ATC step ticker?
Yes.
Every time the MTP service restarts, forces
are hurt. The comment was, if you modify Etsy, MTP set tickers, that you can use that to help facilitate this. I mean, again, I apologize, I don't have enough information about that to discuss right now. I've got some notes from VMware that they sent that I'm going to be reading up and addressing. So if any of you, when you find the stuff, feel free to contact me if you want, and I'll forward the notes that VMware has sent me. But ultimately, what we're going to be doing is using a process to get the time sync to be more frequent, that it's just verifying it. For the domain controllers, since the domain controllers are providing time synchronization for your clients, you still need the W32 time service to run. So the domain controller can be a client, a time client, but it can also be a time server. So we use the no sync setting to prevent these systems from acting as W32 time clients. So traditionally what happens, depending on which status that you're dealing with, your domain controller will be a client of a domain controller or a PDC emulator in a root domain. You don't want that. So the domain controllers outside your root domain or your PDC, unless you're virtualizing that, you only want it to be a server, which essentially means it will be providing time synchronization services for clients. Ensure you understand your Windows time synchronization environment and make sure it is configured correctly before you virtualize. As you can see, just with this quick discussion about the MTP, you still, in the real world, no matter how you slice it, you have to understand some level of Linux. I'm not going to promote, I am a Linux expert, that's why I'm stumbling a little on what you're asking. I know enough to do what I need to do, and again, as I said, I've got some. If I would have read those messages, I could have probably answered a little more intelligently your thing. Make sure you understand your environment for your time sync on how you have it set up with your host, and how make sure you understand how your Active Directory time sync environment is also set up. What I've referenced here is there's a document called the Windows Time Service by Shala Brandolini and Dan Green from Microsoft Corporation. Not to bother writing this stuff down if you can read it, just download this presentation, it'll be there. It's a very good article. They've got a great picture shows, essentially the five stratus for your time sync and how Windows time sync works. and it will help you better understand what you need to do. There's an update to that document, and again, the list is there. And then there's a KB Article 1018. That's what I was kind of sweating both ways of being one, because we do believe that how the article is worded is incorrect. And that's why I was freaking out, because I was referencing some of this based on the incorrect information. So hopefully in another week or two, maybe, if there actually is errors in it, that'll get fixed. Microsoft support. That's a big thing for anything that you're going to be virtualizing. The IAS has created over 1,000 virtual machines in the past 5 years, both lab and production. And to date, we have not had a single instance of data corruption. I talked to various people throughout the conference, and they're kind of like, yeah, right. Well, at least in our environment, we run the VMware Roll 9 Sift. It's a totalitarian environment. It's not a democracy. And by us running it as stringent as we do, we're able to ensure that the ESX environment, the same environment, the FIDO controllers, everything is running as it should be for any loads and whatnot that we're going to put in that environment. Obviously, you may not have that type of control or whatnot. I strongly suggest you do. You don't want people just throwing, creating virtual machines and doing whatever. Run it with an iron fist, and you'll find that you're going to be less prone to running into problems. If you should, however, have any a situation and the problem doesn't appear to be VMware related, for us, the only problem we've ever had, fortunately, were actually Windows problems. But if you have a bad HBA, same issues or whatnot, you actually can contact Microsoft. If you are a premier customer, where only a percentage here probably are, then you do have additional, say, luxuries or safeguards where Microsoft states in their support policies that if you're a premier customer, they will do their best to help you out up until the point they're like, we just don't think it's a Windows issue. I've run into some situations where we've actually had BSODs on some virtual machines. And ultimately what it came to is it was a Windows issue. We've yet to have a problem where Microsoft has actually said, Mike, we need you to put this physical. Your situation may be different, but again, if you run a really tight ship, you document this, and you really understand what you're doing in this virtual environment, you're not going to have as many problems. What's next for us? We are implementing ESX 3.x. We are waiting for the 3.01, because now with 3.01, for those of you that are not aware, you can do hot migrations now from ESX 2.53 to ESX 3.01. You still need to do a reboot to do an upgrade of the virtual hardware, but I didn't want to do a downtime and wait for hours to copy over these VMDKs and all this stuff. So we were waiting for the 3.01 to come out. We are actually already running Virtual Center 2.x. 2.x running with a 2.53 backend, we run into certain challenges and all, but it is running overall very smoothly for us. We're looking to incorporate VisionCore's ESX Ranger and Replicator, the Ranger in particular, to leverage VCD capabilities, and Replicator for us to actually start doing deltas of our mission-critical VMs, sending the deltas over the LAN to our recovery sites. Because what I'm finding now is we're putting things in a VMware environment, it is just opening up the door for us on different types of VI scenarios that are a lot more cost-effective than if we were not using the technology. We're already virtualizing Exchange 2003, but not on a grand scale. As I said, I'm the lead architect for Exchange 2003 in IOS, and the next thing I'm going to be working on is looking at virtualizing our Exchange infrastructure in an ESX 3.01 environment. So, assuming things go well, I might be here again next year, also depending on how you give me an evaluation. Are there any questions? I really appreciate everyone taking the time to come here. Yes, sir.
Are you, now that you've done testing?
Actually, she's just so stupid.
Your ADP, I'm sorry, are you the
stupid
unit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I think that would be great.
The question was, now that you're virtualizing them, our domain controllers, are we distributing out, putting other loads in there? Other VMs, other loads on the host. Are we adding more virtual machines onto the host? Absolutely. Oh, yeah, we're now in the DC office now. I think we're up to like 30 to 35 VMs in the environment.
And what
are you doing to guarantee? How are you guaranteeing the performance level for them? So right now, we haven't had a new level. We're running still 2.5.3, so we don't have the issue, the features of distributed resource scheduling, the resource pool. What we're doing is, as I was saying, as we add more virtual machines into the environment, we make sure when we do an introduction that the overall performance that we've been tracking of the existing virtual machines is not adversely affected. And when I say adversely, I mean is a degradation to the point it's a problem. Because you can run into slightly less high CPU usage or a little less performance, but as long as it's within what we would internally consider acceptable parameters.
So currently you're not using
No, we have yet to have to do anything with shares in our production environment. Anyone else? Let me ask you one thing. For those that are still here, there was one other presentation on domain controls. If you didn't go to it, make sure you download it. It was the ID number was. I'll just lay it on to you if I see you grabbing them. It was from Chris Spinner from VMware, and it really complements this one. I wish they would have had it to do them back to back. It's TAC, that's Tango Alpha Charlie, 9710. That's TAC 9710. It was Chris Spinner from VMware, and it was titled Virtualizing a Windows Active Directory Domain Infrastructure. I'm sorry about that. It was on Wednesday at 2 p.m. in the room. This one. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Prod VMs into the Bank of England, but the government security people wouldn't let me do domain controls. That was the only one.
The issue is for domain controls from a government.
Government security.
Our security environment, we received our security certification for the VMware environment. But the challenge actually is for us, and anyone else, get on VMware's case about them and be merciless, because I've been asking for several years now. They need to incorporate two types of encryption for their VMDK files. One of them is encrypting the entire VMDK. There will be a performance hit for that. What I told them is they need to set up a feature, have a switch. This virtual machine is having tax-free data. I'm willing to take the performance hit. I want it encrypted. The others don't encrypt. You don't get the performance issue. The other thing that I told them is they should come up with a scheme that not necessarily would somehow encrypt maybe just the head of the master boot record, the 1024 bits in a virtual machine. So when you create a virtual machine, have it associated or locked to either a host or a data center. So if someone makes a copy of that virtual machine, they get a VMDK and they try to register it with another virtual machine that's on a host that's in a different data center or whatnot, when it powers on, it's going to ask for a password, so they can secure messaging and whatnot. If you don't have that password, VMware will not let you, say, power on that machine or somehow access that. Granted, in that case, like they're saying, well, someone could still look at the bits, and I said, that's fine. You have those two levels of safeguards. And I've been harping on them from that, because one of the things for us from the IRS is we are starting to virtualize some systems that actually are doing tax processing, but I'm using raw runs. And I don't want to, but I have to, because I refuse to put taxpayer data in a VMDK file until they get that going. So the issue with the domain controller, how we address that is there's only a small handful of people that have actually pretty much, you know, you guys and one other, that has access to the console itself. So the only way you're going to get a copy of a VNDK file is really to have access to that console, because you can make all the copies you want and everything. We also limit who has the ability to edit virtual machines for like mounting, adding hard drives and whatnot. We have a virtualization infrastructure group that does that separate from Windows administrators. So that's how we were able to, from a domain controller standpoint, address that. Now the perfect thing, but seriously, get on VMware's case about that encryption stuff. I'm with their customer advisory council, and I told them, I said, when I come in December again, I'm going to just be beating that drum again until they do it. Yes, sir?
So, quick one. I didn't get what you were doing concerning FISMO.
Concerning FISMO? None of our domain controllers right now for the FISMO world are actually virtualized, but Chris Jenner did in his presentation, he addressed it a little, but if you think about it, there's no difference. The only thing is your in your root domain, your primary, your PDC emulator, which is the one you're going to use to do your external time syncing, you have to make sure you set that up correctly. I see for us probably in the next 6 months or so, our FISMO roles are going to be virtualized, simply for the fact that they're getting close for the hardware, you know, to get refreshed. And I don't see a need for us to refresh the hardware at this point, now that we've got our act together and we know how to do things right with the time sync issue.
Is your PDC FISMO role is still physical?
Is
your PDC still physical?
Our PDC emulator today is still physical. Talk to you in my ears, really.
Does it make a difference on any of your virtual machines, whether you run PC or not?
But the reason we just found it was just easiest just to make them all GCs. But I mean, are you asking like from a performance standpoint or anything? Well, that was, I mean, at least for the Exchange domain controllers, you have to. You've got no choice. And then we just made a decision internal for various reasons that all of them were going to be DC, GC, and DNS servers. We're now stepping back from them all being DNS servers because we're finding, you know, the latency issues for dynamic DNS is causing us a problem for certain applications. And we might even in the future, when we're revisiting, saying, well, we're going to cut back on all of them being global catalog servers. But at least right now, we have no plans on changing all of them being GC, but we do cut, we'll be cutting back on how many of them are DNS servers.
Can you make the DNS
We have two types of DNS. We have bind DNS, because we got our Linux people, and then we got Windows people. And as of today, those are still physical boxes, but we're going to be moving those to bring virtual machines because the people that run a lot of that are, you know, pro Linux. They love the VMware. It's running Linux, and I've been able to demonstrate to them that that it's a very viable, very safe environment. Because some of the presentations, some people are saying, "Well, be careful about running DHCP. It's very chatty and all." I think, from what I've seen, the thunking and everything you see, that's from like web servers and all. The networking loads really from DHCP and everything, I find it is chatty, but it's so minimal. I've yet to see an instance where it's caused us a problem at the ESX level. Anyone else? Yes, sir. Oh, let me get him to use this. Can you come closer? My ears are so bugged. Let me just turn this off. I can.